Sadie, I want to ask you...
Maybe you could ask me a question.
I'm going to ask you a question because everyone is very shy here.
We do have one here.
Already? Great, go ahead.
My interest is I'm very interested to whether you can comment on the fact that Hannah Arendt used the collage as the representation itself, and you somehow create a collage and then a representation on photograph. Mm-hmm. And I'm just interested in that distancing. You know, for Hannah Arendt, the collage was the image, yet you take a step further and you take a photograph of the collage and collage disappears. Sorry, I'm just thinking of that.
Yeah, I just wonder what the question, if there were, what the question was.
Half a question, you know. That difference. Hannah Hope was working in the same building as you were, you mentioned earlier.
She was showing in the top floor of the museum. And actually the transportation and delivery of her work ate up the entire museum's budget, because although the collages are really small, they had to come in a kind of convoy. They were created, they had to come in a convoy all the way from Germany, from the museum that was lending the work. So they had this incredible authority and power, even though they were tiny images. They're just, they're like gold bullion, they're really valuable pieces of work. I think one of the things when I look, I don't know if you saw the Hannah Hoff show at the Whitechapel.
Yes.
And as well as that kind of really interesting thing on a very straightforward level about the kind of, the idea of a new type of beauty, a kind of strangeness, where she's using images of women from advertising and then kind of reconfiguring them so that they become uncanny or strange. I think it was also the section where she starts to use African masks or images taken from ethnographic magazines, where she's kind of collaging these onto female and male bodies to create this new type of creature, if you like, something. And I found them kind of, sort of slightly sort of primitivist in the sense that they were kind of creating an exoticized idea of the African and the other, of the native. Of the, yeah. But then I felt this was part of a certain moment within modernity. So I guess now there's the benefit of hindsight, if you like. And there's also the way in which collage has become such a natural part of the way that images are made, not just in terms of being an artist, but also in terms of advertising, in terms of film, you think about montage, that we accept montage as some kind of, or collage as some kind of default setting for just rearranging the world. You know, that in a way you see the internet as just a vast collage, you know, where or magazines, or you know, colour supplement magazines, or another type of collage, that we get used to that kind of strange, incongruous juxtaposition. Like it doesn't trouble us in the way that it would have troubled people 100 years ago. You know, that now there's a sense in which things can be diametrically opposed or creating a kind of, you know, dissonance. But that's part of the visual space that we live in, and we learn to kind of to create some other type of glue or reading. So I guess I'm going with that that ability that we have to stitch things together. And I guess re-photographing collages really is a way of acknowledging how the photographic can create that kind of glue, you know, to sort of create, you know, if I did a performance where I stood up and, you know, this would be a totally different thing, that the photographic register creates this fixed space where the disc, you know, the dissonance is not dissonant. It starts to sort of melt from one thing into another, so that my hands become, like in the case of the photographs where I used photographic representations of female fig leaf or the wedge of chastity, you think you're looking at a real sculpture, a real three-dimensional thing with my hands prodding it and poking it about. And it's the camera, you know, it's the photographic register that's making you think that, because you believe in that space. So, but what's happening is that the object, the photographic register, is changing the object, but it's also changing me as the protagonist, that I'm becoming part of this archival moment, because it looks as if I'm part of a black and white photograph, but I'm not. So there's something about photography which I guess I would never have really thought about that when I first started using it. It was just a way to make images, but not paint, in a really crude way.
I think that's what's so interesting about your work, because the installations or the creations or the sculptures that you make, which they're glued by photograph, I find so interesting because themselves, they seem to be like a sculpture, something that stands on its own. But the way that you have glued it together as a camera, as a photograph, I just find very interesting. Thank you very much.
Oh, no, thanks.
Enjoy.
How much do the edges of things show? Because we're looking at them on another level of reproduction projected on the screen, which has flattened it out again. So I just don't have a sense of...
Depends how close you stand to the image.
Yeah, about the proximity or
if you get really close, then the materiality often kind of becomes quite inescapable. You can't. I don't try and make it... often I'll leave a bit of tape or a rough cut edge just to... I guess that comes from being a painter. It's not about finish. It's not about perfection. That the faults and the flaws and the mistakes are really part of the work. That I don't mind it when things go a bit wrong, really. And but it's never staged in a hammy way. I don't rip things to make them look deliberately made. It's just as much as it needs to be. And so the accidental, the non-accidental, just coexist, kind of happily so far, perhaps. There's a thing about, I mean, I suppose when people say, the work is photography or it's performance based or it's this or it's that, there's not really, I think these are kind of categories that critics and art historians try and stuff your work into, to save them time from thinking a lot of the time. So they've just got a ready-made set of categories that they can, you can see why people would want to do that. But I feel that there are sort of new ways of thinking, new types of thinking about objects and images that maybe need a little bit more of a kind of theoretical toolkit or a new type of, whether it's a series of neologisms or new types of words, where language and criticism has to bend itself around the object rather than make the object, play ball. I think that criticism has to do a lot of work to think about the nature of actual artworks, to negotiate it, to not just to try and wrap it up and make it neat or to explain it away or
to make it seamless.
Yeah,
to
sort of muffle it. That something about the because images and objects aren't they're quite hard things to police really. And I think I'm not saying criticism does that, but I'm certainly not saying that criticism and discourse is wrong because. I spend a lot of my time talking about art or about other people's art when I'm working at Goldsmiths or elsewhere. So I think discourse is really important, but there comes a point where the object has a kind of a sort of resistance, if you like. It's not this mute, mysterious thing, but it is an object that resists final interpretation. Like it cannot be reduced to language. Otherwise, and if it could, there would be no point in making objects or images. It has something that is always beyond the explained. You can map it. You can, and that's the fascinating thing. I really like the relationship between language and objects and image making because it's a kind of contest it's always moving, if you like. But you work with language in your own work, so I guess, how does that work?
We'll talk about you.
Okay, you're asking the questions, all right. That's
fine. Ali.
Jermaine Greer got into the mix, because there was I got your jumps between the other time periods and figures, and then Jermaine Greer just seemed tangential. So did you talk about her in the fusion?
Yes.
Well,
I just saw her as another, I suppose on a very straightforward level, I just saw her as another sort of interesting, assertive woman who presented herself in a way that was quite challenging, not just in that particular image that I showed, but also she did photo shoots for Penthouse. She often had herself photographed with her legs apart, a bit like Sarah Lucas does or did in her more recent works. Going back to, I suppose, things that are quite autobiographical, I do talk about this when I talk about that work. When I was a kid, my parents were these kind of counterculture not beatniks, but they were into kind of Oz and It magazines and C&D and organic food. And so and they had a series of very interesting collections of magazines like Oz and It, which were kind of counterculture magazines from the 60s. And the people who published It and Oz magazines were often in court cases to do with obscenity and to do with various other things. And they're very political. But they often had quite explicit sexual images. And as a teenager, sort of 11 or 12, obviously this sort of stuff was, I saw it as forbidden because the collection was hidden under my parents' bed in cardboard boxes. And when they used to go out shopping, I used to crawl under the bed and get them out and have a good old look. And then I became fascinated by pictures of Germaine Greer, but also these kind of strange, forbidden images that were clearly political, because my parents were political, but there was something about them that seemed to be slightly worrying and out of control. And so I needed a second opinion on this, so I used to cut some of the more interesting ones out and take to school to show my friends. So anyway, one of the ones I
because your parents would never notice.
No, they did. They found out and they were horrified because they were, because these. It wasn't until about 7 or 8 years later, and these they became collector's items, these magazines. So when they went through them to check the state of the magazines, there were just like this sort of pages missing, and one of the pages was the one with Germaine Greer with her, which I have actually. It was confiscated, but now I have it. But I suppose I was thinking at the time, because I didn't want it just to be a kind of art historical exercise, and the fact that I was in it meant that something about me and my history and my interest and why I was interested in these women must be in it. And so I thought about this. When I saw the Germaine Greer image again, I thought, this is like Duchamp's rotorelief. It really was as simple as that. And then I remember that moment of lying under the bed with a pair of scissors, cutting this stuff out and taking it, recontextualising it, if you like, and getting a different reading. My friends, who obviously thought it was kind of fantastic, because we were school kids who were in quite a kind of conservative part of the Midlands. That's what it was.
Ali, you're wanting to come back on that.
you would never have known.
Because who has not sat in bed with a pair of scissors and their parents' magazines, right?
Yeah, I know. It's thrilling.
Could you say a bit more about the disturbance you felt? Well, someone up there did.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask about what you were saying about using your body as a prop.
Mm.
How important is it that it's you, that it's your body, and what's provoking that choice, and how that kind of, how important is that the
meaning of the work,
the
aesthetic. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's important in aesthetic terms, but it's also important in. I'll come to the aesthetic thing in a minute, but it's important in just in practical terms because I'm always available. I don't have to pay myself, so and I've got all the time. I'm always ready to do it. Whereas if somebody is modelling for you, then it has to be something that's arranged. You always feel slightly, modelling for somebody else is always time-consuming, can be quite boring. So in a way, it's an easy solution. And actually, a lot of people who use themselves say this. It's just so easy. I'm always available. But then there comes the question of being the female model. So I think the fact that I'm not behind the camera is a really important part of the aesthetic of the work. Because there's something, like I've tried, when I was making the work for the Josephine Baker series, the gallery I was working with at the time sent me an assistant, and we tried a few shots where I would perform in front of the camera, if you like, and she would take shots at specific moments. But then I felt that it wasn't my work, and also it lacked for me a kind of maybe only I can see this, but you know, that kind of moment of like it, maybe it couldn't have been any other way, or it could have been another way. This moment of chance, or something being fleeting, something that was fleeting, that I managed to nail and identify. And maybe this comes from being a painter, that the photography perhaps is more about control, and I want to move into a space where there's less control. So that maybe the aesthetic is, there's something not arbitrary, but there's a kind of random element that only I can see, and that's the thing that I like in the work. So maybe it's not visible to anybody else. Something, even the ones where it's just my hands and holding the, or touching the photographs of Duchamp sculptures. I mean, conceivably, I could, you know, if I angled it right, I could look behind the camera and put my hand like that. But I never do that. It's, you know, the camera is far enough away for me not to be able to see what I'm photographing. And then I look through endless possibilities. So every photo shoot, there's usually 40, 50 images perhaps. And then I spend, and that's a really important part of the selection process, that they don't all make it into the final frame, if you like. Or they, some of them, and it's very hard to say why some of them don't work and some of them do. And that's, maybe that's just something that you learn to look for. You know, it's something else that you can't quite put your finger on. Maybe it's just a composition thing, or it's something to do with lighting, or it's where a friend of mine has this great expression. He says something really pops. Like you're looking at the things that you've made, and then something just pops. And that's, I suppose, it's the pop, not pop art, but the sort of moment where it couldn't really be any other way. So that's it. And I think if you're making work, you learn to look for that, and that's the thing that sort of drives you. You know, where you start to recognise your own trajectory. You know, you see your own, the trail that you've left. And then you replicate that in different ways without falling into self-parody, because there's always the danger of that. So maybe this moment when it pops is that way of avoiding